Everything You Know About Indians is Wrong. That's the title of Paul Schott Smith's book of essays on what he calls the Indian business. Smith is a curator at the National Museum of the American Indian of the Smithsonian Institution in Washington. He told Steve Paulson that, unlike other people, Indians aren't allowed to change, even today.
I think it remains something distinct about what makes us different. And the way I would pose it is that, you know, there aren't really very many Indians. And in terms of the iconic Indian and feathers, bonnets, and, you know, the idea that people have all around the world, you know, it's interesting. It's such a brief moment in our history. It was a tiny minority of Indians in the hemisphere. And yet that has so captured the imagination of the world that it's hard to escape. I mean, I've been watching, like most people, I'm sure, Egypt in the last month. And Egypt is, and Egyptians are sort of thought of primarily, you know, what do you think of Egypt? You think of the pyramids, you know. But an Egyptian cab driver is not really expected to be able to translate hieroglyphics or something, right? I mean, there's an idea that there's a modern Egyptian nation state and there's Egyptians that program computers. And it doesn't seem to really take away from who they are as Egyptians. But I would argue that with Indians, this idea of whether we can be in the modern world is somehow in opposition to who we are. So that the more part of the modern world, the less we're Indian. And I think that's pretty unusual in the world.
Is this just an issue for people who are not Indian, sort of their perceptions of what Indians are like, or is this also an issue for Indians themselves?
It's an issue for us. It's something that we've internalized in a lot of ways, I think. And some of it's flattering, you know, the stereotypes about us, they're not all, you know, negative. To say we, you know, have a really special relationship with the natural world, you know, that's not a bad thing. To say that we have, you know, these amazing spiritual understandings, that's, you know, those aren't negative things. You know, the way I've thought of it is a concept of like strategic essentialism, where we actually, I don't know, maybe pander is too strong a word, but we are aware of that sometimes, and it's to our advantage. I'll give you an example. The Iroquois Confederacy in the mid-20th century, trying to rebuild their communities, they wore Plains headdresses at official public events. And of course, they know they have nothing to do with Plains headdresses, but they knew that the public wouldn't really know how to read their version of the kind of headgear that they have that's traditional. And they said, look, if we want to have an impact, we're going to wear Plains headdresses, knowing full well that's not really us. It's a political choice. So in some sense, it's a political choice. But I think then you start believing it in a way, and you start forgetting it's a strategic choice.
Well, and it goes back to some of the most famous Indians of the last, 100, 150 years, Sitting Bull, Chief Seattle, who are held up as iconic figures, but actually their lives were full of contradictions, weren't they?
Yeah, Geronimo is a great example of somebody who went from being basically a bin Laden-type figure in the U.S. national imagination to being part of Teddy Roosevelt's inaugural parade in the early 20th century and becoming a national icon. And so, you know, the idea that Indians were unable to change and unwilling to change, you know, when you look closely at a lot of these examples, you see people who actually were ready for the world, were up for being in Buffalo Bill's Wild West or selling their photographs or being part of a presidential inauguration. And that always, and including how we perceive it as ironic or funny, but I think change has been part of the Indian world from the beginning. That the great imports were what? Guns and horses, right? None of them were indigenous. So somehow it just got sort of fossilized at a certain period where, okay, this is all right. You can have the horses, you can have the guns, but that's it and no more. And I think that's continued, you know, throughout the 20th century into the present.
Well, let me follow up on something that you've touched on, and that's the romantic view of Indians that a lot of non-Indians have. And there's sort of the whole notion that Indians are sort of have this special bond with the earth, that they are sort of have this inherent spirituality. Is this racism, this kind of romanticism?
Yes. It's a benign, seemingly benign racism. But it is, yeah, it's what I would call it.
Why? I mean, in some ways, these are very positive depictions of Indians.
Well, because it says that this is what defines Indians, and that all of us are part of that, or we're not Indian. So all of these things have some truth, but that, you know, going back to how, you know, what really characterized Indians in 1491 were, there weren't any, first of all, and how utterly different most of us were from each other. And so the creation of this idea that says it's these whole set of things that are just one aspect of some people, that becomes predominant, you know, I think that's what justifies that term.
And of course, it's hard to get away from the depictions of Indians in movies. And you say that Indians themselves are very invested in Hollywood's portrayal of Indians. And of course, there have been a lot of movies over the years, going back to the whole cowboy and Indian kind of craze in the old Westerns. Should we take these movie depictions seriously? Do they matter?
For a lot of Indian folks, there's still this tendency to critique the movies based on how accurate they are. And of course, movies are never meant to be accurate. Movies aren't in the business of showing, you know, exact replications of what we actually look like or said or anything else. It's part of a national mythology. But the reason it's so important is because most Americans today think they don't ever see Indians. In fact, they do, because, you know, the gardener, construction worker, you know, might be Mayan, but that doesn't count somehow. We're known to so much of the U.S. public and internationally through the movies, as opposed to us being around a lot ourselves, you know. It gives the movies a much bigger importance, I think, than really almost any other group.
Now, you go on the record as saying that you really hated Dances with Wolves, which in some people's minds was really the first sympathetic portrayal of Indians in Hollywood. Why did you dislike that movie so much?
Everyone else in my family liked it, so I was a minority view. I think most Indians liked it. And it was sympathetic. And it was, you know, just the fact that so much of the movie was in Lakota. You know, that's like, wow, a movie subtitled in Lakota for big chunks of it. That's, you know, that's new. That's impressive. And clearly, without a doubt, you know, that the writer and director and actor, you know, they all were doing it as something to show great respect for Native culture. The trope of a lot of these movies is that they're about Indians, but of course it's a love story between two white people. I mean, you can't really get around that.
So that's the thing that you didn't like, that it sort of, in a sense, leaves the Indians themselves as the main characters, and it focuses on these white people, on Kevin Costner and the woman he falls in love with.
Well, I didn't like the aesthetic. I didn't like the, you know, the movie doesn't give you a lot of choice in how to feel about things, and it presents a kind of a one-sided point of view, which, of course, again, is pro-Indian. It represents a kind of falsification of the complexities of the past, both emotionally, dramatically, and historically.
Can you spell that out a little bit? What does the movie get wrong?
I might contradict myself here in saying it's not about accuracy, but it's telling that the actual book and the author of the book, actually, it was a screenwriter as well, it was all about Comanche Indians. And so it's interesting that you could change it to Lakota from Comanche. And nothing changed. The dramatic arc, the characters, everything else could stay the same. So that's it. It sort of would indicate an idea of the specifics of what one Indian situation is. The Comanche situation was profoundly different than the Lakota situation. You know, it didn't matter. It could be substituted pretty easily.
Well, let me ask you about an institution that you are part of. You're a curator at the National Museum of the American Indian. And you say that you actually have mixed feelings about the very existence of this museum. Can you explain your ambivalence, perhaps?
sort of much like the relationship we have to movies. We're really invested in museums as well. And so there's always been this understanding that museums have a lot of our stuff. They actually have a lot of our human remains, and we don't care for that. And we would like museums to be a partner in changing how the world thinks of us instead of being a way that teaches a world to buy into certain, you know, these stereotypes that don't help us. And I guess I bridle at it because nobody in their right mind would say, you know what, we're going to build a museum of Europe, and it's going to be about everything in Europe. All of the countries and religions and cultures and dances and beliefs and politics. And we're going to do it in, you know, 4,000-8,000-foot galleries. I think people would say, you know, that might be a little ambitious. And so I think there's a way that we accept that this is a reasonable task when it's not reasonable. So, of course, you know, the museum struggles with that. My colleagues struggle with that and try to figure out ways to make this something that can be workable. But I think one of the obstacles is just the very idea that, okay, yeah, there could be a museum of Indians, when in fact it's, you would never really think the same, the Museum of Asia.
We've been talking about this idea that just about everything we think we know about Indians is wrong. So if you could hit the reset button, what would you change? What are the fundamental facts or interpretations that we need to get right?
Well, it sounds a bit like science fiction, but I think there's a huge amount of scholarship, including mostly from non-Indian scholars, that really are beginning to think about contact in 1492 as this profound event that created the world we live in today, that it created the transatlantic slave trade, that these halves of the world that had no connection to each other for forever, now we're part of things, Asia, Africa, Europe, and the Americas. And on the level of microbes and animals and ideas and humans, this was the first moment of globalization. The scholarship that talks about tens of millions of people in the Americas, quite likely more than the population in Europe, and the idea of just this incredible diversity of cultures and civilizations. Those are really sort of opposite of what most of us were taught, which is not many people lived here. All of them were very backward. And the Indian story is of no huge consequence. It's a sad story. It's a tragic story. But it's not really, really important. Those are the kinds of ideas I think the world is moving to. Certainly isn't there yet. And I think that's more than just a correction. That does sort of justify the idea of a reset.
Paul Schott-Smith is an author and a curator at the National Museum of the American Indian of the Smithsonian Institution in Washington. He spoke to Steve Paulson.